Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on how fares the tax protester movement when we come back. You know, a $10 pizza has a 38% tax on it, and a Budweiser six-pack has a 43% tax on it, and a fifth of Jack Daniels is taxed 72%. Now, governments tax us all, and they tax anything that wiggles, moves, or squirms. But what is it that the government does to produce, to prepare, or to deliver, for which the government gets paid 38% for a pizza, 43% for a beer, or 72% for a drink? Does the pizza parlor make a 38% profit on that pizza that they have to buy the ingredients to make, prepare it, cook it, serve it, and then pay rent on the store that you sit and eat it? Why is it that government gets paid more in tax than the people who actually produce, prepare, and deliver the goods and the services that you and I buy? Now, if you'd like more information about tax and status, why don't you call us here at the law school? The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. While you're at it, be sure to ask for our free general law CD package. Now, that's a four-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free of charge. Our school, Tax and Status, is available on compact disc for adult home education. And if you're online, you can go to the website. That's georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email machine and send an email request for your free general law CD package. How's that for a deal? Either way, send an email or call direct. Do it right now before you forget. Remember, georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. All right, we're taking a look here at tax protest. Many people are tax protesters. I don't know what percentage of the population are actually tax protesters. We do know that one-third of the taxpayers of America don't file or pay. One-third, that's one out of every third. Every third taxpayer ain't filing no mo'. Well, that isn't something new. We found that out back on July 9th, 1985. Roscoe Eggers, he was the commissioner of the Internal Revenue Service in the Reagan administration. He said that as of that date, July 9th, 1985, that 32 million Americans had not filed their tax returns. Now, that's a pretty shocking statistic, I would say, and I just saw that the other day again in the International Forecaster, that it's one-third. Well, back in 1985, it was about one-third. Now, those people don't actually qualify as tax protesters. Tax protesters have an agenda. They've got a goal. They've got a purpose in life. They're not just out trying to scrape off a little extra money so they can drink a little more beer on Friday night or eat a pizza. These people actually want to abolish the IRS. They want to abolish the Federal Reserve System. They want to take us back to gold and silver coin. They want to do something constructive for America. They want to straighten out this slimy mess. So they've got a political agenda, and they're serious people. They're kind of like the anti-abortion people. They've got an agenda. They actually want to do something. Most people don't want to accomplish anything. They don't give a rat's rectum one way or the other. They just don't want to pay the tax, and so they don't. And then there's a lot of ways to evade or avoid paying the tax. Of course, that has a certain amount of risk that goes along with it. Now, fortunately for all of those risk takers, the government can only prosecute about 18,000 of those tax protesters a year. Well, let's see, you got about 30 to 40 million people in the country that aren't filing or paying, and you can only prosecute 18,000. Now, of course, the states also prosecute a bunch. I don't know what the numbers are for the states, but for instance, in California, the State Franchise Tax Board, they're a real bunch of tigers out there. And if the IRS don't get you, then the Franchise Tax Board will. And, of course, there's a lot of other states out there, you know, that are prosecuting people for tax evasion and tax fraud and one thing and another. And these tax protesters have come up with a number of novel arguments to bring into the courts. Unfortunately, all the novel arguments have already been brought in. They've already been argued. They've already been lost. And now we're on the second round. We're arguing these same frivolous and meritless arguments that we were arguing in the first 20 years. We've been arguing them in the second 20 years. And I said, we'll be arguing these same crummy arguments in the third 20 years, and it isn't going to do us any more good. Let me remind you, while I'm thinking about it, of destroyed arguments. Write that down in your notes, little grasshoppers. And go to this webpage. It's HTTP, you know, :// And then the thing you want here is fly.highway.net. That's FLY dot, and here's a toughie. It's HIWAAY. Two A's in there. I don't know why Larry did that, but evidently somebody else must have had highway, so he put two A's in his. That's FLY dot HIWAAY dot net. Flyhighway dot net. That's Larry Becraft. Now he wrote a treatise, I don't know, several years ago. Well, I can tell you when it was. 4/13/2000. 5 years ago, he wrote a treatise called Destroyed Arguments. And he went through about 30 of these tax protest arguments. And I did a program or two on this. So if you'll go to our webpage, georgegordon.org, then click on to the archives, and then take a look in there and see if you can find, there'll be an alphabetical order, Destroyed Arguments. Be under D, Destroyed Arguments. Click onto that, and there's about 30 more. And Larry Becraft now is an attorney. He's been working with tax protesters for many years. He's specialized in income tax and taxes in general for as long as I've known him. Hell of a nice guy. You're going to like him. He's very witty, very likable fellow, very intelligent. And he knows where the bodies are buried with this tax issue. And he wrote a number of them. I'll just give you a couple of three here, you know, such as simple facts regarding we are subjects of the British Crown. Taxes are contractual. Implementing regulations. 14th Amendment, folks. Title 26 is not positive law. These are all arguments that have been used over the years by people just like you and me to go into court and argue that, well, I'm not guilty of tax evasion. I'm not guilty of willful failure to file. They had to come up with some kind of an excuse. And so, you know, we go in there and we make these crummy arguments and they fall on their face. And Larry Becraft said, well, let me take a few of these on and let me explain them. And he did. And he did a pretty good job of it. So I thought, well, let me go a step further than that. Now that I've explained to you the destroyed arguments argument, let's take a look here at the contention that the IRS must prepare federal tax returns for a person who fails to file. Proponents of this argument contend that Section 6020B obligates the IRS to prepare a federal tax return for a person who does not file a return. So those who subscribe to this contention believe that they're not required to file a return for themselves. Well, the law in Section 6020B provides the IRS with a mechanism for determining the tax liability of a taxpayer who has failed to file a return. Section 6020B does not require the IRS to prepare tax returns for persons who do not file, and it does not excuse the taxpayer from civil penalties or criminal liability for failure to file. And then here's some relevant case law. United States versus Lacey, Schiff versus United States, and Moore versus Commissioner. For instance, in the Lacey case, the court, in upholding the taxpayer's conviction for willfully and knowingly failing to file a return, stated that, quote, the purpose of Section 6020B1 is to provide the Internal Revenue Service with a mechanism for assessing the civil liability of a taxpayer who has failed to file a return, not to excuse the taxpayer from criminal liability which results from that failure. So you don't file your tax return. You need to put up a defense or an argument. You walk into court and you say, well, the IRS had that duty under 6020B. All right, well, somebody else already made the argument, boys and girls, and because somebody else already made the argument and a court somewhere said, no, we're not going to buy into that. It goes through its process and then it gets written up in the literature and that becomes the case law of the nation. I mean, this case that's called United States versus Lacey is the law of the land. I don't know if it's good or bad. I don't know if it's right or wrong. I'm just a reporter. I'm just here to tell you, if you go into court and you make that argument, it's go to jail, don't pass go, don't collect $200. Now, if that's what you want to do, get after it. If you got something better to do, then let's think of some other alternative. Now, remember I said there's 1,997 of these kind of arguments. I'm going to take you through a few more of them. For instance, let's take a look at the meaning of income, taxable income and gross income. The contention here is wages, tips, and other compensation received for personal services are not income. Well, what do the courts say about that? We know what the tax protesters and the tax patriots, and we know what all of these gurus tell us, but what do the judges say? What does the IRS have to say? What does the CSR or the CRS have to say about it? Well, this argument that wages, tips, and other compensation received for personal services are not income asserts that wages, tips, and other compensation received for personal services aren't income because there is allegedly no taxable gain when a person exchanges labor for money. Under this theory, wages are not taxable. They're not income because people have basis in their labor equal to the fair market value of the wages they receive. Thus, there's no gain to be taxed. Some take a little different approach and they argue that the 16th Amendment to the Constitution did not authorize a tax on wages and salaries, but only on gains or profits. Here's what the law says. For federal income tax purposes, gross income means all of the income from whatever source derived and includes compensation for services. Any income from whatever source is presumed to be income under Section 61 of the Internal Revenue Code. Unless the taxpayer can establish that it is specifically exempted or excluded. And in Reese versus United States, the court stated, an abiding principle of federal tax law is that absent an enumerated exception, gross income means all of the income from whatever source derived. The 16th Amendment provides that Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes on income from whatever source derived without apportionment among the several states and without regard to any census or enumeration. That's the Constitution, Amendment 16. Furthermore, the U.S. Supreme Court upheld the constitutionality of the income tax laws enacted subsequent to ratification of the 16th Amendment in Brueschaber versus Union Pacific Railroad. And since that time, the courts have consistently upheld the constitutionality of the federal income tax. For a further discussion of the constitutionality of the federal income tax law, see Section 4 of this outline. All compensation for personal services, no matter what the form of payment, must be included in gross income. This includes salary or wages paid in cash, as well as the value of property and other economic benefits received because of services performed or to be performed in the future. Furthermore, criminal and civil penalties have been imposed against individuals relying upon this frivolous argument. There you go. and the relevant case law, Commissioner versus Green at Glenshaw Glass Company. Commissioner versus Kolaski, United States versus Connor, Lonsdale versus Commissioner, McCoy versus United States. Here's our old friend, John Cheek versus United States. Let me read John Cheek for you. The Supreme Court reversed and they remanded Cheek's conviction of willfully failing to file federal income tax returns and willfully attempting to evade income taxes solely on the basis of erroneous jury instructions. The court noted, however, that Cheek's argument that he should be acquitted because he believed in good faith that the income tax is unconstitutional is unsound. Not because Cheek's constitutional arguments are not objectively reasonable or frivolous, which they surely are, but because the law regarding willfulness in criminal cases does not support such a position. On remand, Cheek was convicted on all counts and then sentenced to jail for a year and a day. That's cited in Cheek versus United States. Now remember I said there was an exception to that called Aiken versus U.S. Now if you could show, either by parole evidence or if you could bring in the book and say, hey, listen, here's what the book said, I believed it. It's got to be true and sincere. I mean, you can't come in here flip, you know, and say, hey, you can't convict me, I read this book. But I mean, if you were serious and you walked in and you say, well, I'm really sorry that this happened. I read this book by Irwin Schiff and it says right here on page 37 that I should do X, Y, and Z, and I did X, Y, and Z, and I believed in good faith that that was true, accurate, and correct. The Supreme Court carved out a little niche for you there which fits into reliance. It's called the Aiken Subjective Good Faith Reliance Defense. But again, it's only good for you one time because once you've used it, you can't use it next year because, you know, after you've been through this trial, you now know, don't you? Same thing is true with reliance under Murdoch. You know, once you've relied upon your paid professional, you got to go back to that paid professional every year. And if your paid professional said every year you're not a person required to file, put it in writing. Make sure the guy gives it to you in writing and give him a check for $150 so you can prove that you paid him. You could use that time after time, but he's only going to do that for you once. You know, once they find out that your name is A.J. Porth or John Cheek, you know, that isn't going to fly a second time. Especially when you come back into court the second time and they say, hey, listen, weren't you here last year or the year before or 5 years ago? Now, religion. I said that there's an exception based upon religion, but that doesn't mean that if you just walk in and say, hey, Jesus told me not to pay the damn tax, that that's going to fly. I mean, there's some standards that have to be made. You know, some hoops you got to be able to jump through. And those hoops you'll find in Seeger versus U.S. That's spelled S-E-E-G-E-R versus U.S. or U.S. versus Seeger. I forgot who came first there in that case. Probably U.S. And there's five winners and five losers. You get those in order. Pay attention. And follow the rules of First Amendment procedure, and I think you'll be more than happy with the results that you get. Now, I've been doing that for 30 years, and I'm more than happy with the results that I've received. All right, now gather around, little grasshoppers, and let me tell you a little story here. I had a guy, you've probably heard this name, Irwin Schiff. Irwin Schiff, hell of a nice guy. Jewish fellow from up in New York when I knew him. He lived in Long Island, I think it was. No, Connecticut. He lived in Connecticut. He used to be on the lecture circuit back in the 80s, and from time to time we'd cross paths, you know, when we were out talking to people. And he'd been in this tax protest thing a lot longer than I had. I want to caution you now that I haven't been a tax protester. I'm not a tax protester. Never was a tax protester. I sympathize with him. I don't deny that. I think the income tax is a bad program. I think it was a curse on every American. But, you know, we Americans, we English, we Anglo-Saxons told God to stick it where there's no daylight back in 1 Samuel chapter 8, if you'll remember. And so God said, don't call me, I'll call you. The income tax is a penalty that we all pay for our insolence to our God. But then that's another story for another day. But anyway, old Irwin Schiff, you know, is a pretty nice guy. And we'd had lunch a couple of times and chit-chatted back and forth, you know. And he'd been around for a lot longer than I did. And so I figured he probably knew a whole lot more than I did. I was a businessman. And I knew a little about law and a little about tax and a little about this and a little about that. But, you know, he seemed to be kind of a guru on income tax. And he'd written several books on income tax. He is out selling this income tax program and this don't file and don't pay and, you know, so on. So I kind of figured he must know what he's talking about. Well, one day back in, I don't know, about 1985, 6, 7, long in there, my wife brought the newspaper in. She said, hey, look at this. Irwin Schiff has been indicted for tax evasion. And I read the article, I don't know if it was in the New York Times or something, and I said, well, God, that's too bad. Get him on the phone, Jack, and let me talk to him. So she got him on the phone, and I said, Irwin, good talking to you. So listen, why don't you come down here to school and let me teach you what I know? And that way you'll be smarter than I am, because you already are smarter than I am and you know more than I do. But let me tell you the little bit that I know. I don't know much, but I know a little bit. And you don't have to tell me anything that you know, but you'll know everything that you know, plus you'll know the little bit that I know. I don't know very much, but I know this little bit. And between the two of us, maybe we can help you. And he said, George, I love you like a brother. He said, but I'm up to my rectum in alligators, and I just haven't got the time to come down here and do that. What with this court case and what with my busy schedule and all. So I said, well, I understand how that goes, Irwin, and I certainly don't want to interrupt your busy schedule over there. But you know, the offer's open, and I want you to know it's free. You don't have to pay me. I mean, I'm not asking you for compensation or money or anything, just want to help. He thanked me. And sometime later, he was convicted. My wife came in and said, look at this, here in the paper, Irwin Schiff was convicted for tax evasion. I said, yeah. Well, that's too bad. I'm sorry to hear that. So Irwin went to jail, and one day my wife told me, she'd talking to somebody, said, Irwin Schiff's out of jail. And I said, well, that's good to know. I'm very happy for me. Got out of jail, and I hope he lives life happily ever after. Well, some time went by, you know, and one day my wife came in with a newspaper account, and she said, Irwin Schiff's been indicted again. Oh, I don't know, it was 2 or 3 years later, you know. And so I said, well, get him on the phone. And so she did, and I talked to him a little bit, and I said, well, I see here in the paper you've been indicted for tax evasion again. And I said, now, Irwin, remember last time I invited you down here to the school, you were too busy. Now listen, I don't know very much, but I know a little. And I would like to share the little bit that I know with you and see if I couldn't help you here with this case. Why don't you come on down here? It's free of charge, gratis, and let me see if I can help you. And he said, George, I love you like a brother. But you see, I'm up to my you-know-what in alligators, and I just haven't got the time. And what with this court case and all of my busy schedule and all of the things that I do, I just don't have time to do that, but thank you very much. So I said, well, goodbye. And so I went about my business, and he went about his business, and some time went by. And one day my wife came in, and she had a newspaper, and she said, Irwin Schiff's been convicted. And I read the article, and I said, well, that's too bad. I'm sorry to hear that. And some time later, I saw in the paper where he had been sentenced to jail again. And so then some more time went by, a year or two or something like that. And one day my wife came in and said, Irwin Schiff's been released from jail. And I said, God, that's wonderful. Really tickled, really happy. Hope he gets after his life, and I hope he lives happily ever after. Well, some time went by, and I don't know how long, a year or two, 3 years, something like that. And one day my wife came in, and you guessed it, Irwin Schiff's been indicted again. And my wife said to me, Do you want me to get Irwin on the phone? And I said, no. No, there isn't any need for that. And she said, well, why? In the past, every time that Irwin is indicted, you want me to get him on the phone so that you can offer to take him through school and tell him what you know, why don't you want me to do that again? I said, well, Irwin is up to his asshole in alligators. And he hasn't got time to come down here. What with the case and all, and what with his busy schedule, he doesn't have the time. We already know that. Well, sure enough, some time went by. I don't know exactly how much. And one day my wife came in and said, Irwin Schiff has been indicted. Been convicted. And then some more time went by and he'd been sentenced. And I said, well, I'm sorry to hear that. It's too bad. And then not too long ago, somebody said that he'd been indicted again. Now, that's the fourth time that I know of. And Irwin Schiff is in the literature many, many times. You go through here and Irwin Schiff has been arguing this and arguing that and one thing and another. Nice guy. I love him like a brother. But, you know, you don't have to be a Rhodes Scholar to figure out that his program doesn't work. Now rest my case. Contention. Only foreign source income is taxable. Each one of these different headings over here, you know, from my perspective, you know, people come in here, boy, they really get excited, you know, and they want to share this with me. I get emails almost every day, and somebody is trying to share with me some new tax protest position. Most of them aren't new. Most of them have been around for 20, 30, 40 years that I know of. I want you to remember grasshoppers. Now, you're talking to a very, very old grasshopper. I remember most of these ideas when they were brand new for the first time. You know, the idea that only foreign source income is taxable isn't new. That isn't something that came out of the Bush-Clinton era. That goes clear back, you know, to John Kennedy. I can remember that back in the Kennedy years. Somebody came up with these ideas, and they took them in, and they argued these cases. Now, in the relevant case law here, concerning only foreign income is taxable, I said I could remember that back in the Kennedy years. That's not true. It isn't back in the Kennedy years, but it goes back to, see, the earliest case here that I can see here that's been adjudicated was 1982. And it was called the Great West Life Assurance Company versus United States, where the court stated that the determination of where income is derived or sourced is generally of no moment to either United States citizens or United States corporations, for such persons are subject to tax under IRC 1 and IRC 11, respectively, on their worldwide income. And because of that, a lot of little guys, little grasshoppers like you and me, you know, we came into the game and we said, well, you know, this foreign income. And then they brought in Washington, D.C., and they said, well, Washington, D.C. isn't in the United States. Or I'm from the Republic of Wisconsin, and Wisconsin's not in the United States. And I mean, we got all kinds of crazy arguments over here that, you know, sound a little bizarre, you know, when you first hear them. And I've read some of the briefs, and people send me this kind of stuff. And sometimes I'll come into school here, you know, and there'll be a guy sitting here in class, and I'll kind of give him short shrift. And I had a guy in here one time, he really got angry with me, and he said, you know what your problem is, Gordon? You just don't listen. You just don't listen. And they get a little snotty when they do it. It isn't, you know, Mr. Gordon, you just don't listen. It's, you just don't listen. See, we get a little short with you. And I don't mean to be short, you know, and give you short shrift, but I've heard this crap for so long, you know, that I don't need to hear it for the 37th time. It hasn't worked for anybody else. It isn't going to work for you. And you know, this young grasshopper comes in here and he listens to some patriot guru out here, and he comes in and he says, "Wow, listen to this. This is the cross. This'll make Dracula just fall on his back." Yeah, but it didn't make Dracula fall on his back in the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, or the 90s. What makes you think he's going to fall on his back now? So tuck it away in your heart. You know, I don't know everything, boys and girls, but I've been around for a long time. I've been watching this for a long time. I've been teaching this for a long time. And I'm here to tell you that that don't work. And it's not just Irwin Schiff. I've probably watched 50 of these Irwin Schiffs come and go, you know, over the years. And they've all got these real neat arguments. And there's 1,997 of them. And the courts have been very patient. And the judges have just bent over backwards, answering all of these arguments that people have raised. So you can't blame the judges. And then once they've told you, you know, that's the new law of the land, and that's the way the game is going to be played from here on out. So you can disagree with it, and you can get real mad about it, and you can throw yourself on the floor and kick and scream and have a real old-fashioned temper tantrum, but it ain't going to change nothing. So my suggestion is we ought to rethink this and come up with a better plan. Rethink it and come up with a better plan. Need a little better mousetrap here. Hang on. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard 7 days a week around the world on the Internet. For more information, just call the law school or go to our webpage, georgegordon.org, and then you'll see our webpage, and you can see these archives, and you can see the various programs that we have here. If you're interested, call us, and if you're not, let it lay. How's that for a plan? And remember, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. And the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that's open to individuals by pre-arrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you can't come to school, we'll come to your home by way of compact disc and papers. And for more information, just go to our homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour website is updated every week. It has our radio log schedule and archives. It can be accessed through the website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, economics, history, health, news, and current events 7 days a week. The law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, please call the law school at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to the authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that the authors or the publications that we endorse or recommend are going to reciprocate. Most of these authors and publications that we cite on the Law Hour are political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not necessarily endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review either. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, management, or the staff of this network or local radio station. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, remember our website, georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct, 417-273-4967. Hey, here's another one. The contention is that Federal Reserve notes are not income. You ever heard that before? Well, it's been argued in court. Some people assert that Federal Reserve notes currently used in the United States are not valid currency and they cannot be taxed because Federal Reserve notes are not gold or silver and may not be exchanged for gold or silver. This argument misinterprets Article 1, Section 10 of the United States Constitution. I think that Federal Reserve notes can be exchanged for gold or silver. I've done that a couple of times. You know, I walked into Charlie, put Federal Reserve notes on the counter and said, gold. And he puts gold up on the counter. United States coin. I mean, United States $50 gold pieces. And he'll trade those for Federal Reserve notes. If you want to know how to do that, just call. We'll tell you more about that. And it goes both ways. I mean, you can take gold in there and you put it on the counter. And you can say, paper. And he'll give you paper money for your gold. So I've heard Article 1, Section 10 arguments, and I've been into court, and I've argued Article 1, Section 10, and I've written on it, and I've written books, and I'm pretty familiar. I'll tell you, the guy that really knows gold and silver is a guy by the name of Edwin Vieira. Edwin Vieira. He's a lawyer back in Maryland or someplace. And he wrote a book called Pieces of Eight. Pieces of Eight. And I'm telling you, little grasshoppers, if there's anybody in America that knows gold and silver, knows the laws, knows all of the relevant congressional acts concerning gold and silver coin from 1792 to last night at 5 o'clock, the guy's name is Edwin Vieira. If there's anything that guy doesn't know about gold, it ain't worth knowing. That's my conclusion. Now, I don't know much. I'm just an old country boy, an old plumber, general contractor by trade. And I read his book, and I want to tell you that it's a pretty good book. It's a little esoteric. I mean, you're going to get in here, and you're going to read a lot of words that you don't understand the meaning of, and you're going to get kind of bored. Ain't like Mickey Spillane, you know. Mike Hammer is a hell of a lot more action-packed than Edwin Vieira and Pieces of Eight. But, you know, on balance, if you want to learn a little something about gold and silver, Article 1, Section 10, and how Franklin Roosevelt and the New Deal and Fair Deal screwed us out of our gold and our money, and how the Woodrow Wilson administration came in and gave us the Federal Reserve and shafted us. Well, that guy's got the whole story right there in front of you. And got the relevant case law and got the names, the dates, the times, the places, the facts, the witnesses, and the evidence. Guy's a lawyer. What more can I say? And he hasn't been able to get our gold and silver back yet. Now, what in the hell chance do you think you've got, you plumbers and carpenters, electricians, and truck drivers out there and Sally housewives, huh? Huh? Come on. Let's grow up and get real and smell the coffee. Now, there's a lot of good people out there like Larry Beecraft and Edwin Vieira and a whole host and plethora of others that are pretty knowledgeable about this issue. And I'm here to tell you, boys and girls, that we have gold and silver coin. And the powers that be didn't give it back to us in 1986 for no good purpose. It shut our mouths, is what it did. When they gave us back our gold and silver, they shut us up. So I say, well, let's use our gold and silver coin, and let's make money doing it, and let's sit down, shut up, and ride the bus, and smell the coffee, smell the roses, and have a good time in the process. But there are some that are still using Federal Reserve notes are not income, and some assert that Federal Reserve notes currently used in the United States are not valid currency and cannot be taxed. Now, the law says Congress is empowered to coin money, regulate the value thereof, and of foreign coin, and to fix the standard of weights and measures. Article 1, Section 8, Clause 5. Article 1, Section 10 of the Constitution prohibits the states from declaring as legal tender anything other than gold or silver, but does not limit Congress's power to declare the form of legal tender. So in United States versus Riffin, The court affirmed a conviction for willfully failing to file a return, rejecting the argument that Federal Reserve notes are not subject to taxation. Congress has declared Federal Reserve notes legal tender. Do you hear that, little grasshoppers? Congress has declared Federal Reserve notes are legal tender. And Federal Reserve notes are taxable dollars. The courts have rejected this argument on numerous occasions. By the way, in Title 31, Section 510123, along in there, it'll tell you plainly, Federal Reserve notes are legal tender for all debts, public and private. I agree with you, it shouldn't be that way. But, hey, boys and girls, I don't make these laws. I don't make these rules and regulations. I'm a reporter. I just came here to report. Let me tell you the bad news. Bad news is Federal Reserve notes are legal tender for debts, public and private, and they are of equal value to gold and silver coin. How do you like that? And Congress has the power to do that, and by God, they done did it. And so if you don't like it, tough. Here's some relevant case law, United States versus Rickman. 1980, the court affirmed, clear back in 1980, this guy walks in and he says, hey, Federal Reserve notes are not income. So in 1980, the court affirmed the conviction for willfully failing to file a return and rejected the taxpayer's argument that the Federal Reserve notes in which he was paid were not lawful money within the meaning of Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution. U.S. versus Condo. God, I remember old Condo. Condo. It was from Long Beach or someplace down there. Armand Condo. The court upheld the taxpayer's criminal conviction, rejecting as frivolous the argument that Federal Reserve notes are not valid currency and cannot be taxed and are merely debts. United States versus Daley. God, I remember Daley very well, too. And that was 1973. The court rejected as clearly frivolous the assertion that the only legal tender dollars are those which contain a mixture of gold and silver, and that only those dollars may be constitutionally taxed, and affirmed Daley's conviction for willfully failing to file a return. That was back in 73. Jones versus Commissioner, back in 1982, the court found the taxpayer's claim that his wages were paid in depreciated banknotes as clearly without merit and affixed and affirmed the tax court's imposition of an addition to tax for negligence or intentional disregard of rules and regulations. How do you like that? So when I say that, you know, many of these arguments are pretty old, there's two periods of time here. Now, 1965 through 85, about 20 years, the heyday of the tax protest movement, I think led by Armand Condo and A.J. Porth and Daley and, you know, quite a few of these other guys over here. And then Schiff comes in here about 1980 or so, and then he leads the second drive in the tax protest movement up to about the present, another 20 years. And I've just been sitting here as an old grasshopper just watching these guys go by and taking notes. You know, I've been taking notes all these years and watching the results that come down. And by God, the results that I see coming down aren't too good. So you might want to tuck that one away in your heart, boys and girls, before you run out here and start taking up some of these arguments. Remember, 1,997 losers and three winners. So let's make sure that we get on those three winners, huh? And stay off of all these losers. Now keep in mind that all these arguments that I've been bringing to you here this is program number five, isn't it? Five programs now, all losers. And I told you the three winners. Murdoch, 1932, Aiken, 1979, and Seeger, 1963 or 4. Let's take a look at the meaning of certain terms in the Internal Revenue Code. Contention. Taxpayer is not a citizen of the United States and thus is not subject to the federal income tax laws. Some individuals argue that they have rejected citizenship in the United States in favor of state citizenship. Therefore, they are relieved of their federal income tax obligations. A variation of this argument is that a person is a freeborn citizen of a particular state and thus was never a citizen of the United States. The underlying theme of these arguments is the same. The person is not a United States citizen and is not subject to federal tax laws. And that's because only United States citizens are subject to these laws. Let me ask you a question here while we're thinking about this. I'm going to underline that. You know, and that's because only United States citizens are subject to these tax laws. Let's suppose, for the sake of our discussion, the Beatles come over here from England, and they stage a big concert in New York City, and they make $1 million. Do they just take that $1 million, stuff it in an attaché case, jump on the airplane, fly back home, and they don't pay any tax over here? Do you believe that? Well, they're not citizens. I've listened to these kind of arguments going around over here, you know, and if you just stop and think about it for a minute, you know, they don't make any sense. I don't think I can just go over to England and put on a school over there in England and take $1 million, stuff it in an attaché case and fly back home. I'll bet you that the British government would be on me like flies on stink. I think they want to cut a fat hog in the back and take some tax out of that, don't you? Yeah, so aliens, when they come over here to the United States and they do a little work, they have to get a thing called a green card, you know, and they got to get a taxpayer ID number. It's called a TIN, T-I-N, taxpayer identification number. And yeah, they can do that. They can come over here and they can stage a big concert and sing and collect a bunch of money and pay their taxes and stuff the balance of it in an attaché case and go back home. There's nothing wrong with that. But the idea that, you know, I'm not a citizen of the United States and I can work over here and do all these things and I don't have to pay any taxes, you know, just doesn't really make any good common sense now, does it? Think about that. The contention, the taxpayer is not a citizen of the United States, so he's not subject to the federal tax law. The law. The 14th Amendment to the Constitution defines the basis for U.S. citizenship, stating that all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. The 14th Amendment therefore establishes simultaneous state and federal citizenship, claims that individuals are not citizens of the United States, but are solely citizens of a sovereign state and not subject to federal taxation, have been uniformly rejected by the courts. Here's some relevant case law. O'Driscoll versus IRS, 1991. The court said that despite the taxpayer's linguistic gymnastics, he is a citizen of both the United States and Pennsylvania and liable for federal taxes. United States versus Sloan, 1991, the court affirmed a tax evasion conviction and rejected Sloan's argument that the federal tax laws did not apply to him because he was a freeborn, natural individual, a citizen of the state of Indiana, and a master, not a servant, of his government. Well, that guy was a little out of touch with reality. You know, we Americans, you know, used to have public servants. We used to be the masters. And the government employees, the public servants, were the servants. That's no longer true. That's no longer true. Now, the government politicians and government agents are masters. And the people are the servants. And the people have gone to the government to get social security numbers and welfare and food stamps and benefits. And every time you do that, you declare yourself to be incompetent and unable to manage your own affairs. And you create a guardian-ward relationship. You know, and just reporting the facts. So when you're out here working on a job, paying Social Security, you have declared yourself to be incompetent. The Social Security account number is prima facie evidence that you're incompetent and unable to manage your own affairs, for which you have applied for and you have received a guardian. And this guardian is managing your financial affairs and saving and putting away money for you. because you can't do it for yourself. And it has to be done for you by your guardian, who's going to take care of you when you get to be an old grasshopper and you can't take care of yourself anymore. I mean, come on, boys and girls, let's grow up. Here's another contention. The United States consists only of the District of Columbia, federal territories, and federal enclaves. Have you ever heard that story before? Some people argue that the United States consists only of the District of Columbia, federal territories, Puerto Rico, Guam, and the federal enclaves, American Indian reservations, military bases, and it does not include the sovereign states. According to this argument, if a taxpayer does not live within the United States as so defined, he is not subject to federal tax laws. I wonder who thunk that up. Somebody did. But here's what the law says. The Internal Revenue Code imposes a federal income tax upon all United States citizens and residents, not just those who reside in the District of Columbia or federal territories and federal enclaves. In United States versus Collins and in Brueschaber versus Union Pacific Railroad, and noted the United States Supreme Court has recognized that the 16th Amendment authorizes a direct, non-apportioned tax upon United States citizens throughout the nation, not just in federal enclaves. This frivolous contention has been uniformly rejected by the courts. Now, if you're listening to my voice right now, do you have a Social Security number? Well, that Social Security number is prima facie evidence that you're a citizen of the United States. Prima facie. Now, it may be that you're not a citizen of the United States and you've got a Social Security number, but you had to go out there to get a Social Security number, boys and girls. You had to go out there and steal it off of somebody else and steal somebody's ID, or you had to make it up out of your own head. To get a Social Security number, you had to walk in to the Social Security office and produce proof. I remember I had one years ago. I had to go down and prove to that nice lady behind the counter that I was born here in the United States. And that I was qualified to become a slave. Slavery in this country doesn't just fall upon the shoulders of just anybody. By God, you gotta qualify. And I did. And I got my slave status. I got my mark of the beast. I had it for quite a few years, and then one day I woke up and I said, what in the world am I doing with this thing? My excuse was, when I got mine, I was 11 years old. I wasn't too bright. I'm still not too bright, but I'm smarter than that. And you know, here's big grown up people, you know, they run around over here and they're telling you that, well, I'm not a citizen of the United States, you know. Now, if you don't have a Social Security number and you said, I'm not a citizen of the United States, you got a leg up on the average Joe Sixpack. Some relevant case law here in regarding Beecraft. The court observing that Beecraft's claim that federal laws apply only to United States territories and the District of Columbia has no semblance of merit. Well, you know, that was Larry Beecraft, and he went into court and he made that argument. And, okay, so once in a while we're wrong. I was wrong once. You know, it happens. Have you ever been wrong? Did you ever make a mistake? Well, you know, you got quite a few thousand people out here called tax protesters, and they've made a great big grievous mistake trying to argue this income tax with Social Security numbers in their pockets. And what the real bottom line is, they don't want to admit that they've made a mistake and that they're wrong. It's kind of like President Bush over here, you know. You probably voted for Bush. I remember back in the Nixon years, you know, when Nixon was being impeached, or was about to be impeached, the Watergate inspection, you know, was going on. They were investigating. And, my God, you couldn't find anybody that voted for Tricky Dick. You know that? Nobody. You'd say, well, you voted for him. No, I didn't. I couldn't figure out how that guy Nixon never got into office. Nobody I ever talked to voted for him. Now, I bet you if you start talking to people today, you find, I didn't vote for Bush. I didn't vote for Bush. Oh, I don't know. He got a few more votes than the other guy, so somebody had to vote for him. But, you know, we made a mistake with this guy Bush. That's the bottom line. And it's time that we all woke up and said, hey, listen, this guy Bush has got his head up the wrong end. And we made a mistake, and we need to get rid of this jerk. That's the bottom line. So, same thing is true here with tax protest. Hey, listen, we made a mistake. We've been following these gurus, and we need to get our head out of the wrong end over here and come out and smell the coffee, and let's see if we can get our head screwed on straight. U.S. versus Ward. Barcroft versus Commissioner. You know, there's all these various and sundry cases that have come down. Contention. Taxpayer is not a person as defined by the Internal Revenue Code. Thus is not subject to federal income tax laws. Contention. The only employees subject to federal income tax are employees of the federal government. You know, contention. Federal income taxes constitute a taking of property without due process of law, violating the Fifth Amendment. Contention. Taxpayers can refuse to pay income taxes on religious or moral grounds by invoking the First Amendment. You know, contention. Federal income taxes constitute a taking of property without due process. Contention. Taxpayers do not have to file returns or provide financial information because of the protection against self-incrimination found in the Fifth Amendment. Contention. Compelled compliance with federal income tax laws is a form of servitude in violation of the 13th Amendment. Contention. The 16th Amendment to the United States Constitution was not properly ratified. Thus, the federal income tax laws are unconstitutional. Contention. The Internal Revenue Service is not an agency of the United States. Have you heard any of these? They've all been argued. And every one of these contentions, I could cite, oh, probably half a dozen cases where people have argued that in various jurisdictions across the country and lost. So I'm just here as a reporter to suggest to you that you rethink your position. You know, these gurus that go around telling you about straw men and the UCC and all these various and sundry arguments you know about and about law. If they're so good, all these arguments are so good, how come we don't have any victories? I want you to write me an email and send me some cases where these contentions have actually won, where the courts, you know, and the tax courts and the federal courts and the state courts have agreed with us, and hey, you're right on there. Could you do that? Because I haven't found a single one that's won yet, and I've been watching this now for 40 years. 40 years, boys and girls, from 65 on. All right, we're about out of time. I got to leave it right there. We'll be back next time talking about this thing of tax protesters. I'll give you some more inside skinny on that subject when we come back next time. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. For more information about the law school and the Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. It's open to individuals by prearrangement. Remember, the law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact desk. For more information, just go to our homeschooling page on the website at georgegordon.org. Remember, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. I've got to leave it right there. We'll see you next time. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, and good night, friends.